Welcome to another Distinct Nostalgia by MIM.
Brought to you in partnership with Life Rooms and Mersey Care NHS Foundation Trust. Staying well, staying home.
We're returning to Coronation Street for this week's Distinct Nostalgia soap episode, and this time we're going back over 40 years to remember a character who played a very important role as corner shopkeeper and eventually wife of street stalwart Alf Roberts, played by Brian Moseley. Alf, who would one day marry Audrey, played by Sue Nichols, had been a character in Coronation Street almost since the beginning. Renee Bradshaw first arrived in the street in 1976, and just 2 years later, she and Alf were walking down the aisle. Renee was played by Madge Hindle, who'd been starring in another successful Granada TV series, the comedy Nearest and Dearest, with the eccentric comedy actress Hilda Baker and comedian Jimmy Jewell. As she recalls to MIM's Ashley Byrne, it was while in Nearest and Dearest that legendary Corrie producer Bill Podmore picked her out for the street role.
Bill Podmore used to direct Nearest and Dearest, or the latter two episodes of series of Nearest and Dearest, and therefore I'd never been in the street, and it was handy to get somebody in the street. Of course, if you live in the north, they don't need to pay you expenses, you know. There's always that as a. So anyway, I joined in 76 and his invitation. You know, I didn't have to read for it or anything like that. He knew what I could do, and it was a shop, and I said, well, you know, I couldn't even work the till. I was fairly useless, but it was nice. I quite enjoyed being in. You know, whether had they not written me out and whether I would stayed much longer, I don't know, because I realise there's a wider world outside, and I may or may not have stayed in. I don't really know. I can't tell. But however, they wrote me out.
Of course, but in terms of the character itself, I remember her being quite a sort of, she was quite chatty, wasn't she? She was a bit, could be a little bit gossipy as a character.
I think they wanted me to be like Ina Sharples, taking over sort of an Ina Sharples, that Violet Carson, you know, Violet Carson played Ina Sharples. And I think they wanted more that sort of character. But the problem was that I ran the shop, and you can't be icy like that if you're running a shop, can you really? You know, people wouldn't be coming in the shop. and it was rather difficult to be like that in the circumstances that they put me. And it was very peculiar. But I remember Violet, I was terrified the first day. I found myself in the green room with Violet Carson. And I was terrified of her. And she said to me, "And how are you?" And she was very posh. She came from St. Anne's, and lived in St. Anne's. And she was said, "How's the day gone? And have you enjoyed your first day? Are you enjoying your first day here?" And I said, "Yes, it's very good." And she said, "And do you come from a theatrical family?" I said, No. She said, "Your husband's not in the business." I said, No. I said, "My husband's a solicitor." And she said, "Oh, quite right, dear. So much better than those dreadful actors." She was great, really. She played the piano, you know, and and always at Christmas, we always had a piano in the Robber's Return at Christmas, and she would be playing it. And then when we'd finished shooting and everything, she'd start and we'd have a sing-song, and it was just lovely.
I was
lucky enough to work with a lot of the original ones. It had been going 16 years when I went in, and or thereabouts, and of course, there was a wonderful Annie Walker, played by Doris Speed, and Jack Howarth played Albert Tatlock, and of course there was lovely Pat Phoenix there, and Bill Roach, of course, who was still there, and they were great characters, and Doris was just wonderful, Doris Speed. She was her first time she spoke to me, it was about the second day, and she said, "Oh, welcome, Madge. I'm so loved you in Nearest and Dearest. It was just lovely. And do you play bridge?" And I said, "No, actually, Doris, I don't." And she said, "Oh dear," she said, "I thought proper actors played bridge." When she well into being there. We were in the Rowers' Return, and there was a guest in called Roger Brearley, and he was a very tall actor. And we were doing the camera rehearsal, and he was dodging about a lot. And she said, "Dear, what are you doing, Roger? You know, sort of dodging about like that." He said, "Well, I'm trying to keep the shadow from you. You know, my shadow's on you all the time. So I'm trying to get it off." And she said, "Quite right, dear. The dole queues are full of young men who have cast a shadow on my face." Wonderful.
Do you think that people like Doris and Violet and whatever were actually quite, you know, do you think their characters and them were quite similar in a way?
No, not really. Well, certainly Doris wasn't. Doris was, Doris was very, very funny. She was, oh God, she was a funny, very, very amusing woman, and a left-wing socialist as well, and she was just a wonderful character. And Violet was different in her own. She was very posh. Was Violet very, very posh indeed? No, they were great characters, and I love being with them. I love listening to them because they'd done so many other things. And Violet Carson played the piano for Have a Go, Joe, you know, which was Wilfred Pittles many years ago when I was a child and I was a little one.
She went back a long way, didn't she?
Oh, yes, definitely.
With regards to, just talking about, you mentioned Jack Howarth. Now, yes. he was a bit of a character, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. It was wonderful. It was great. It was Jack. He came up to me and he said, the first thing he said to me was, he said, no. He said, I believe you come from Blackburn, Madge. And I said, yes. He said, oh, he said, our David was conceived in Blackburn. I said, Jack, you've only just met me. I said, you shouldn't be telling me things like that. And he said, I think I'll call you Blackburn. He said, they call Cleopatra Egypt. There's no reason why I shouldn't call you Blackburn.
And so he kept calling you Blackburn throughout the entire time.
Yeah, he did. He always called me Blackburn.
Fabulous. Now, your first storyline was with Doris, wasn't it? Was it with Annie Walker?
That was first. Cracky, was it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think you were a bit of a rival for her or something. There was some. I think she was. Because you came in to take over the shop, and I think...
That's right.
I can't remember exactly what it was, but
I think... I remember having... we went to court about licensing for alcohol, because the shop wanted a license for alcohol, because in those days you had to have, of course. I remember being a court scene with me and Doris trying to stop me from having a liquor license, and I remember she said to me, the wardrobe had given me a very bright green coat to wear, and well, quite smart, but a bright green coat, and just as the floor manager was waving his little white handkerchief, saying, you know, they were getting, and I had to start the dialogue, and he was just about to do it, and she went, Madge, what? She said, who told you suited green? And then I had to start with the whole proceedings. She was quite naughty.
I remember that green coat, you know. I do remember it. I remember it.
I think I wore it quite a lot.
They must have thought it suited your character. Now, of course, you're in the shop, and as you say, the shop is quite restrictive in a way, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yes, it is.
But you are there to take in the gossip, aren't you? That's the whole idea, isn't it?
When you're at the shop, the whole idea. You do a bit of serving, and the till always hit you in the stomach. It didn't really work. It was a bit like do you remember Oh No Hours?
Yes.
When Ronnie Barker used to hit the till, and he used to come and hit him. Well, ours did that. It was just very difficult to manhandle, and it was a prop that I never really got on with.
And you were in Open All Hours as well, weren't you? Of course.
Yes, that was were good days too.
Indeed. So, of course, so you had the shop. You were there. I think you'd had a. I think the backstory was that had you split up from your husband or something. Or?
No. I'd come to join my brother. I had a younger brother who had gone in the shop first. He'd already been in it a month or two, and then I went in to be his sister, and then my character took off from there.
Apparently what happened, going back to the beginning of your character, Reedy visits her brother, Terry Bradshaw.
Terry. That's right, I was called Bradshaw, yes.
And notices that the corner shop is for sale.
Mm.
She then decides to purchase the corner shop and opens it as Reedy Bradshaw.
I remember that.
Evicting Gail Porter, Helen Worth,
Trisha
Hopkins, Kathy Jones, and Elsie Tanner from the upstairs flat. So,
oh, right. Was that right?
So your character wasn't very popular at the beginning.
No, she wasn't. I'd forgotten all that.
So who was the guy that played your brother then? Let me have a look.
I think he's died. It was a nice lad. But somebody told me that he'd died.
He was played by a guy called Bob Mason.
Bob Mason, that's right.
And yes. he died in 2004.
I thought he died.
He's
a young man.
He was 53, that's
all. Yes, I thought so.
But he'd been in a lot of things. He was in all sorts of things over the years.
Yes, I noticed him quite a few times in various things, yes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they married me off to Alf Roberts.
Well, let's talk about that, because obviously that was the main thrust of your period was getting together with Brian Moseley. Tell us a bit about Brian and what it was like working with him.
Oh, it was lovely. We did enjoy one another's company, and in fact, now and again, the four of us, Norma, who was his wife, and Michael, my husband, we sometimes would have an evening meal together, you know, or something like that. We became friends. He was a very, very nice man, lovely family man. He had six children, and he was just a sweetheart. But he was very naughty, you know. I would say to him, if we had a particularly lot to do and the storyline was us, I said, come on Brian, let's just nip it. When other people were rehearsing, I said, come on, let's just nip into the corridor and just go throw the lines at one another. And he'd say, Oh God. you do bully me. He said, Christ, I'm not really married to you, you know. And he used to say things like that. But he was good to work with, very good to work with. He was always very sound and solid, and you know, and he was good fun too. No, I had a lot of admiration for Brian. No, he was a sweetheart.
Of course, he'd been in the program for quite a long time, hadn't he? Before,
yes, he had.
When did you get a sort of inkling that they were likely to marry you off with his character then?
Oh, well, you pick up the script on the Wednesday, and there it is. oh, hello. You know, and you start sort of, and then you thought, are they going to pal us up together? You know, and there was a build-up, of course, a little build-up, but it's never a very big build-up because they haven't time. But you just get the script and you just find out from there, you know, how it progresses. And then, of course, there was a marriage and all of that malarkey, and it was okay. But it was a very, very funny thing. It always tickled me that every time there was something like a marriage in a thing, we Bill Podmore always used to, we always used to have some a little glass of champagne, all of us, to celebrate.
It seemed ridiculous to me, you know, because we weren't really getting married. It was lovely, though. It's a nice thing to do.
And what do you think about Alf and Reedy? Do you think they were suited?
We'll be back after a quick break.
But you still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there.
Look,
we all artists, man. We go, you feel me? We gonna have this like
Bro, me and my man Kyle, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gotta lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it. Don't play with it. Take that shit serious.
Well, no, people didn't. Members of the class never thought so. We were all right. We worked very well together. We were fine, you know. And it didn't matter to me, and it didn't matter to Brian, I don't think. And we worked well together, fine. And we had a bit of fun, you know. And it was it worked very well. I think the writers didn't quite know what to do with us because. Brian had said right at the very beginning, I believe he'd said, he said, I would like a happy marriage. I'd like it to be a happy one. He said, because, you know, marriages are always splitting up and there's drama. He said, why can't I always just be mundane, an ordinary marriage, you know? And of course, they can't do ordinary. You know, they've got to do big stories and stuff. So, of course, the big story was him being a widow.
Indeed, we'll come up to that in a moment. But of course, while you were in the program, this was the sort of late 70s. So as you say, you got all the older characters who'd been there a long time. They were still there. But you also got some newer ones. You got Ivy, I think, was in there at that point, and
that's right.
You know, all those kind of people. So the cast was starting to grow a bit, wasn't it?
So there were the ones that. Ivy and all the ones in the they were all they'd all been, you know, and sort of.
There were singers and dancers and music hall artists, you know, Lynn Perry and
Liz Dawn.
Oh, she's lovely. They were lovely. But although Doris was so very nice to them, she always thought of them as turns rather than actors. Oh yes, yes, and not in a disparaging way at all, but just that's the sort of word she gave them, you know. Because I suppose because they hadn't, but then neither had she. She hadn't come up that way. Her parents were in the variety, you know, and she was carried around. She was born in a trunk, you know. It was sort of
life for her when she was a child. Yes,
indeed. And of course, you were there when, of course, the fantastic Jean Alexander was still in the programme.
Yes, it was.
And how was it with her? Because she was very different in real life, wasn't she?
Well, yes, she was. She was just very remote. I mean, she didn't talk much, and she was just very remote. I've absolutely nothing I could tell you about her.
Because, you know, she's perfectly nice, but I didn't know her at all. Nobody did, I don't think. I don't think anybody really. We all admired her. My goodness, we did. She was very, very good. But she was just remote and perfectly nice. But I didn't know her really. So I can't tell you much about her.
I get the impression. I interviewed her when she was still alive, and I get the impression she was quite a private lady. Actually, quite.
She was. She was. She was quite remote. You didn't know. You know. She didn't. She never got to know anything. She never mixed socially. Now, occasionally, you see, we did make personal friends. In fact, I have always just admitted, put the phone down on Thelma Barlow,
who played Mavis, who became a close friend of mine, and I have one or two. Whereas she never made close friends like that. You know, she just went home. She came on the train from Southport. To Salford Station. She walked back to Salford Station from Granada, got on the train. She liked to catch the 4:20 train. She used to be a little bit annoyed if she had to wait for the 5:20 train. And that was more or less it, you know, and she didn't. I once met her mother. She once brought her mother. We once had a little scene together outside in a garden. Don't ask me why. But... and she brought her mother, who was charming, lovely lady. But that's the nearest I ever got to her socially.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting. Because some people are like that. That's, you know, that's the way they work, isn't it? You know, absolutely. Now, of course, you mentioned Thelma Barlow, who eventually, of course, ended up being Mavis in the shop, didn't she?
That's how we became friends.
I didn't know her slightly, because I'd become part of the furniture at Granada by being in Nearest and Dearest. So I did know quite a few people, vaguely, you know. I was in Nearest and Dearest, and she came in the street, and I met her in the canteen. And that was that. And then when I went into the street, she was there. She was permanently in the street when I went in. And we became quite close friends. As I said, I'd only just put the telephone down from talking to her.
Fabulous, fabulous. When you started in 76, I think that was also the year that Johnny Briggs started as Mike Bolden.
We started within a week or two of one another. I can't remember which was first, but I know that we used to cling together a little bit. Because he lived in London, he got expenses, whereas I didn't because I lived in the north of England. And he said, I've got something, and he used to call it his Guinness money. And he said, "Come on, we'll go. I'll take you out for lunch." And so he would take me out for lunch quite often with his expenses. And we were great good friends. Yes, he was
great. It was Johnny. Yes, we used to have a few laughs together. It was good. I was there when Pat Phoenix was there, and all I can say about Pat Phoenix,
I couldn't take my eyes off her for the first 2 days. She was incredibly beautiful. She just was so beautiful. She had lovely red hair and she had amber eyes. She was stunning to look at. And she's a nice woman too. She smoked like a chimney. So did Jean Alexander, by the way. That's one thing I do remember about Jean. She was a more or less chain smoker, you know. And she'd have a tot of whiskey. That's about the thing that Jean Alexander you wouldn't think about, would you? that's what she did.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't at all.
You wouldn't put her down as a chain smoker.
Well, Hilda was, of course.
Hilda was, yes, so was Jean.
So, I mean, Pat Phoenix and Doris and Violet, who played, you know, we're going back to a period now when they were, in a way, they were, well, I mean, people in TV programmes today are stars and all the rest of it, but they were huge in a way, weren't they?
Oh, huge, absolutely huge. And, of course, they all came. Nobody knew who they were.
You know, they weren't stars when they started it. They were going into this little thing at Granada for sort of 6 weeks, and that's all they thought it was. And of course, it's still going after 60 years.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
and of course, the period you were in it is my favourite period because it's just when I first started watching.
When you were a child.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and of course, there was also Bette Lynch, of course, who was
Julie
Goodyear.
Yeah, Julie and I got on very well together. She's very, very comical as Julie, you know, and we used to sit together sometimes in the green room and laugh a lot. Did a lot of laughing. We'd have a little lunch together now and again and a drink sometime, yes, Julie and I.
Now, of course, today they do episode after episode after episode. In those days, I think it was two a week.
In our days, we did two a week.
Our schedule was if you were in film, any of the filming, you went in on Monday and then you started Monday afternoon rehearsing. We did a little bit of rehearsal we never did a read through. You did a little rehearsal on Monday afternoon because you'd done the filming in the morning. All day Tuesday working. Wednesday we did the producer's run off two shows. And then Thursday we had off. We didn't come in on Thursday until Thursday afternoon about 1 o'clock, and we started recording the beginning, and we worked until 6:30, and then we came in at whatever time you were called on Friday and worked till 6:30, and hopefully you got two shows in the can.
Dear Miss Jones, may I call you Clementina? Firstly, may I say how nice it was to meet you in the park yesterday.
Distinct Comedy presents Letters from One Border Terrier Pup to Another.
Apparently, socks that cannot accommodate toes because they have large holes where said toes should be fail to fulfil any real purpose.
Based on true events seen through canine eyes.
I now know that I'm definitely afraid of both heights and, not surprisingly, of big ladies.
Dear Clementina, new episodes every Thursday. Available to listen now at distinctnostalgia.com.
Sincerely yours, Stanley Burke. Woof!
You spent 4 years in it. And that's quite a long time to be in a huge, which was, I mean, still a huge program, but in those days it was even bigger than it is today in many ways.
You know, it's the nearest an actor ever gets to a proper job.
Yeah,
is that.
Yeah.
You see, because, and it worked
very well for me because I had a young family and I could drive to work and drive back and still get things for a meal and so on. And my husband wasn't in the business, but he had his own career. And it was a very normal life, you know. I went to work, and it was sort of a normal life, which actors don't usually have, because you're either working at night if you're in the theatre, you're working during the day, and usually away from home, filming or in a television studio if you're working during the day. So it isn't like being a teacher or working in a bank or working in a shoe factory. It's not a proper job, you know. And people don't think so now. A story I remember my mother used to look after pick the children up sometimes if I couldn't do, and she was waiting for them one day outside school, and a young woman came up to her and she said, "Can you see these two little girls that are coming out of school now?" She said, "They're my Chindle's daughters," and my mother said, "Oh yes," she said, "They don't look neglected, do they?"
Awful, isn't it?
My mother was so embarrassed by it, she went and hid behind a tree because these two little girls naturally would call up to her, and this woman would be very embarrassed.
Yeah,
my mother went to hide so that this woman would be embarrassed about what she just said. It's extraordinary. But that's what people thought in places like that, then, you know,
you're fine if you're a teacher or fine if you work in a bank and so on, but, you know, you don't do that.
It's so strange.
You were sort of letting the side down a bit, I suppose. That's what
I suppose so. And women just didn't do that, you know. I suppose it would have been all right for a if my husband had done it. I suppose that would have been all right. But women sort of no. The times have changed.
Did it change your life though?
Not. I suppose it might have done. I don't really know quite. I would have taught had I not done that. I think I'd have gone back to teaching. I might have done. I don't know. I don't really know. It just happened so ordinarily, the way the progress me doing that I didn't even give it a thought, to be honest. It was just something I did, and that was, I just got on with it. And I don't know that it changed my life particularly. I can't see us living anywhere else, really, I don't know. I mean, I suppose my wage helped, but then I would have been earning a wage of some sort anyway. So,
did it alter the way people saw you for other parts? Or
did, oh yes, yeah. It did that.
It had both, really. Some people wouldn't employ me because I'd been in the street, and some were very happy to do so because I had.
Just thinking about your character and her image, as it were, you know, her hair and her glasses and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of that was you? Was that
most of it, because, I mean, my hair is red.
I'm 82 and it still is a bit, and which is very nice. But I'm very, very short-sighted. And so I said to Bill Podmore, I said, I'll have to wear my glasses, because I didn't wear them in Nearest and Dearest. And it's very difficult because I'm particularly short-sighted, very. And I had thick glasses. And I said, I can't do all the props in a shop without my glasses on. And so I went to my optician and had some made that I didn't wear ordinarily, you know, that I would just wear. I just wore for the shop, for the program.
But they were my prescription.
Right, okay, I get you. I remember the glasses. I remember the glasses. I remember your hair. And I remember the green dress.
And the aprons.
And the apron, yeah. The apron.
Yeah.
Then there was one or two storylines, little storylines, things that happened, which I don't know if you remember these. What about where Rini accompanies Elf, Fred G and Mavis on a fishing trip?
Oh, God.
Do you remember this?
I remember that. Yes.
This is Thelma and I. Oh, God. And I can't swim. And I said, you do know I can't swim. And they said, oh, Christ, that's a bit of a drawback. You know, anyway, and they said, so they had a double. Well, it was a man, actually, a man to come in and just do it when I had to go underneath, when I had to go under the water, which I had to do. But Thelma and I splashed about in the water, you know, and did all that. Oh, it was ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. Anyway, they gave us a tot of brandy afterwards when we brought it out.
Where was it filmed? Do you know?
I can't remember where it was filmed. It's a rather nice place with a lovely little river, and it was very picturesque. What's he called, Fred G?
Fred Feast, in real life.
Fred Feast, that's right, Fred Feast. And he used to live at Scarborough. And he'd had to stay in Manchester during the week, but on Monday he came straight from home, and he used to say on Friday, he'd say, do you want any fish or anything? He said they do lovely crabs and things, and he used to bring with half a dozen crabs or something like that, and dole them out to the cast. We'd order them on a Friday, and he'd bring them on a Monday. It was great.
I think he was in Kez, wasn't he, as well?
I think he was. Yes,
like
he was. Indeed.
Lynn Perry was in Kez as well, wasn't she?
Yeah,
that's right.
Going
back now, in terms of your marriage to Elf, apparently everyone thought that Elf was marrying you for your money. Apparently, that's what they thought at the time. Yeah.
And, oh, I can't remember.
And you ended up having a very small service in a registry office.
That's right, we did. Yes, we did. I remember that. Yes, and I had a green. I had a peppermint coloured little silky suit on and a little half hat with feathers on.
Oh, I remember your hats. I remember the hats. Yeah, I remember the hats.
And my big glasses.
fabulous. So I mean, it was an interesting time. And then, of course, it came to. You know, you were in it for 4 years, and I think you were there when they had the ITV strike, weren't you? Were you there that year?
I remember somebody, Stephen Hancock played Ernest Bishop, who was married to Emily, and I remember being on the floor. This wasn't the main strike, but he caused a strike they always used to stop at 4 o'clock for cups of tea and so on. And when we got back, and Stephen was desperate to catch his train. He lived in Stratford. He was desperate to catch his train, and he said, oh, come on, let's get on with it. Oh, come on, where are they? Let's get on with it. And they said, well, we can't get on because we're waiting for somebody to come and just couple the sink up, because she had to turn the water on. And
I'll do it.
And so he just got on and he coupled it up, and it caused a strike. They all walked out. Oh, God. When was the strike?
It was 79.
Oh, was it? Oh, I was there then. Yes, it was then. Yes. Were they doing Brideshead Revisited then?
That was on a couple of years later.
Yes, but they were doing it then.
They might have been filming it.
I know. I remember seeing them. I remember. Yes, because they were ages
before they could get the two fellas together again, Jeremy Irons and Anthony Andrews. Yes,
that's right. That's right.
And it was quite some time before they could get them together again.
I mean, Granada, when you think about it, did some massive projects, didn't they? I mean, there was that,
oh,
and there was Duel in the Crown.
Oh,
yeah.
You were always sitting next to somebody. You know, I mean,
I was asked. I happened to be out of the street for a couple of weeks, you know, and they'd written me out for, you know, as they do write you out, and I wasn't in. I think Brian and I were supposed to be on honeymoon, I think, and Laurence Olivier was doing a play at Granada called Hindle Wakes, and he picked a cast that really didn't have Lancashire accents, so they asked, could two people from the street go and just keep talking to them so that they pick our accents up? And Brian and I went. And they thought, no, you see, you couldn't get that sort of job anywhere else. And there was Laurence Olivier, you know, sort of. It was wonderful. There was always somebody there that you went, oh, heavens, oh, so look, it's Omar Sharif walking through, you know, oh, gracious. Yes, there's always that sort of going on.
In terms of your character's departure, as it were, in 1980, I mean, all that I mean, they really did go to town in terms of writing you out. It's quite a dramatic ending, wasn't it?
Oh, God, yes, it was very dramatic. I mean, it's the film.
You'd been, now the storyline had been that you'd been learning to drive, hadn't you, or something?
That's right, yes.
And I was arguing with Brian, who was in with me. I had proper lessons, because I know there was a man came in to be the driving instructor, I remember, nice fella who came in to be the driving instructor just as a guest appearance, so I know I remember having driving instructions from him, and doing a bit of that, and then I was in the car with Brian. I think, yes, I was in the car with Brian, I think, and it came to temporary lights, and they were green, and I couldn't get, and I slowed down to stop it, and I couldn't get it going again, and I got it going, and just as it changed again to red, and of course naturally there was a big lorry coming the other way and it crashed into me.
I remember it really well, like yesterday. It's bizarre, isn't it?
Thank God they did it, and then they reversed the shot,
right,
to look like it was very technical and all of that.
I remember it really well, and I was only 6 years old at the time.
Yeah, yeah. One of my daughters was 14, and she crawled onto my knee when we were watching it, with her arms around me. And our younger daughter was 14 at the time, and a bit too big for sitting on mummy's knee, but she did.
It didn't go down very well with viewers, did it? They didn't want you written out, did they?
No, they didn't want me written out. No, I got a lot of letters.
It's very, very odd. I still get fan letters now. Only two or three, you know, but I still get them now and again. I got one the other day. It was my birthday yesterday, and I got a card which said Madge Hindle, television actress and ex-mayoress of Blackburn, settle. And I got it.
Fabulous. I mean, that's amazing that it can get to you, isn't it, really? I mean...
Take 23.
Distinct Comedy presents...
Oh, hello. I'm Jolyon Karp. I'm doing a voiceover.
Oh, hello.
Experience a day in the life of... Voiceover guy.
Take 13.
I'm playing a pirate.
Are you sure you're in the right place?
Written and performed by Jonathan Kidd.
Take 24.
Aha! Splice the main brace, me hearties. Get on down to Captain Jacob's boat supplies. Sail is now on. Get it?
Oh, good, let's treat that one as a run through.
Aha!
Available now on the Distinct Comedy Podcast.
Okay then, can we do a series of less piratical wild ahas in threes and we'll splice them on? That okay, Paul?
The trials and tribulations of a life spent in voiceover.
Sorry, I only have two lemon with honey.
I'd like my coffee. I shall scream without a coffee.
New and original comedy.
Softer.
Aha!
Well, actually, on reflection, I'm not happy with them.
I like what we had, all rough and piratey.
Listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or I might have to give you a black spot.
That was blood out of a stone. Won't use him again.
You've had as well as Coronation Street, you've had an illustrious career. And, you know,
well,
the stuff
I've,
that...
I've had a career.
but before Corrie, of course, you were in Nearest and Dearest, which was very special to you, wasn't it? You did a lot with Nearest and Dearest, and you've done things...
Well, it was my first series, yes. Yes, it was the first time that it was a series, and I had, you know, it was sort of like a proper job, yeah.
And you were working with some real characters there, weren't you?
Oh, with knobs on, yes, I was indeed. Jimmy and Hilda, oh, goodness me. They never got on together at all, which was great for the actual character, because they didn't get on. They weren't supposed to get. They were always shouting at one another
in the scripts and so on, you know. And the storylines were always about them falling out and everything, which was good that they actually did. I mean, they didn't like one another at all. And it was because they'd both been variety artists, and Hilda had been on her own, except she used to have a stooge, but it was a stooge and it could be anybody. It wasn't a partner. Whereas Jimmy had had a partner, Ben Warris, Jimmy Jewell and Ben Warris. And I didn't like to say to Jimmy Jewell that I'd asked him for his autograph when on Blackpool Central Pier when I was about seven. I didn't like to tell him that.
I mean, I listened to a play not so long ago on Radio 4 about Hilda Baker, where Alison Steadman played Hilda Baker. It was only a 45-minute thing.
Yeah,
and Hilda Baker, Nearest and Dearest, came a little bit before what I remember, you know, as a kid. I don't quite remember Nearest and Dearest.
It was in the late 60s, early 70s.
Exactly. But I learnt a lot through this 45-minute thing. I mean, she was a She was a strange woman in many ways, wasn't she?
She was a dragon. Well, but you see, she wasn't really. You see, people didn't like it. She was difficult. She was very, very difficult. And you could see right through her. She was a child. You know, it was. You could sit back and just watch how she behaved. And she it really was insecurity. You could just see it burst out of her soul, this insecurity, and you could just see that, and she was, you know, she was a little ugly person, and she wanted to be beautiful and glamorous and so on, you know, and of course she didn't take to me because I was 30 years younger than she was, and the same sort of age as the producer and the writers and the director, you know, and we were all of an age, and she was a bit jealous of me in that respect, but I understood why she was. I could see that because she'd been a big star. She had been, and this was acting, and she could act. She was the one who could act. There was no question about that. And other than Jimmy, of the two, if we're putting the two of them together, she made me laugh. And you can't dislike somebody who makes you laugh.
Indeed. Did you, I mean, obviously there was the intensity of doing the comedy, but did you all socialise as well?
Well, Jimmy never did. Jimmy didn't socialise at all. Not at all. He didn't speak much to anybody. He was a solitary figure. He was all right with me. He was fine. I went on tour with him at one point, but he was all right. He was all right, but he wasn't a sociable animal at all. He thought he was, but he wasn't. And but Hilda desperately wanted to be sociable, and she would be. She'd do little things like you'd be behind her in the canteen queue, and she'd say to, when you were paying at the till, she'd say, "I'll get that." And she would get your lunch for you, you know, things like that. She was very generous. And then she'd say, and sometimes the producer, Peter Eckersley, who became a great friend of mine, and one or two others, they'd say, they'd come to the door when we were rehearsing and give a little acknowledgement of, "Are you going for a drink tonight?" You know, flick your hand up just before we came home, and I'd nod, and then she'd say, "Are you going for a drink?" And so she wanted to be with us and that, even though she was a lot older than us, you know. She thought she was 30, you know, and she used to do a wonderful sketch of getting sitting on top of a bar stool, and it was hilarious. And she was just very, very funny, naturally very, very funny. And you could see where the insecurity was, you know, and she wasn't good at learning lines. That was always difficult, and it used to send Jimmy. Oh, he used to go raving mad, and because he knew all his lines, but I used to say, "Well, yeah, you know, he knows his lines, and that's about all. You know, it takes more than learning your lines to be an actor," and which is very. But I mean, she was, for my mind, she was a lot better than him, and although she had an awful lot wrong, you know, and she wouldn't learn her lines, or she couldn't learn them. I don't quite know which, and it was because she was sort of. Always interfering, always wanted to see get it right, and she'd look at you and think, and I could tell, I knew that she thought he wasn't doing it the way she wanted him to do it, and of course she wasn't in a position to say so, and she didn't say so, but it used to throw her very much, you know, and that, so therefore this animosity crept in. Oh God, it was a thing and a half. It was extraordinary, so much so that in the business. Everybody talked about it, and we used to get a guest every week. There would be a guest come to play a small part or something, and they'd all come and say, "We're dying to come into Nearest and Dearest," you know. And you'd meet people and they'd say, "Have you done your Nearest and Dearest yet?" And things, that sort of thing. But you know, it was talked about in the business very much.
It lasted a long time, didn't it? It was on quite a long
time. It was 5 years, I think, on and off. Yes, but
I mean, not continually. You know, we did one in the, we did a clump in the spring and a clump in the autumn or something like that. I can't just remember, but we certainly did two series. We'd do 13 or 14 programmes a year in two lots. You know, because I know I went to the theatre between.
point.
It's quite interesting that Bill, because Bill obviously knew you in that, in Nearest and Dearest, and then decided that he wanted you to do Coronation Street.
Yeah.
But in those days, what tended to happen with serials or soap operas or whatever was that they didn't tend to use people who had been in other things, who were well known in other things, did they?
No, they didn't. But I wasn't terribly well known, you see.
I wasn't recognisable in Nearest and Dearest because I was only 20. I was only about, I think I was about 28 when I started, and I was about 32 or 33 when we finished. I can't remember. I was only in my very early 30s, late 20s, early 30s, when I did that. And, of course, I played a middle-aged woman. And so I wasn't recognised at all in the street. So it was quite safe, actually, to go into other things. You know, people didn't recognise me from Nearest and Dearest, thank goodness.
What was Bill Podmore like as a producer?
Oh, it was all right. I mean, I knew him when I was a cameraman. He was a cameraman on Nearest and Dearest at first. Yeah. And then the first series, he was one of the cameramen. And June Howson directed it. Peter Eckersley produced it. And June Howson directed it. That was the first two series, I think. And then the next one, Bill was directing it. And as I said, Bill had been a cameraman, very good cameraman. And that was his come from.
I just always remember his name being at the end of the credits and loads of programmes, right. You know. Brass, I think he was producer of Brass as well.
Yes, he was. No, he did lots of things with Bill, yeah. No, he did. He was very good. He was very good. He was very concerned. It was, you know, once she upset me once on the floor as we were recording,
and I was sort of stifling back tears. You know, she was being quite not very nice to me, and obviously they saw this, you know, what's happening to Madge, and he came down on the floor and sorted it out in the most wonderful way, without saying anything, without a showdown or anything like that, you know, and he did it absolutely spot on, you know, getting it, writing it, and it was she was being
quite unkind and so on, you know. Anyway, she used to do little tricks like that. But as I say, you know, she did make me laugh.
Well, let's just round up and talk just finally about Coronation Street, because this is the 60th year. There's something about serials or soaps, isn't there, that people do connect with. It's something quite special.
Yes, they do. Yeah. They do. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is? What do you think it is about that kind of thing?
Well, I think it's because they get used to seeing it. They get used to seeing that these people are entering into their sitting rooms twice a week or three times a week, and they think they know them, and it gets to a point where I mustn't miss it. Now they don't need to miss it, of course, because there's iPad and God knows what, so
they're all right. But in my day, you know, you'd be in at 7:30 if you wanted it, and people were.
Indeed.
They pull things off for Coronation Street sometimes. You
had to be there. So when you look back at it, your time in it, obviously I brought back some memories today because we've been talking about it, but what's the lasting thing that you always remember about being in the programme?
Well, it was a very happy time of my life. It was very happy,
not just because of Coronation Street, but because it being in something like that allowed me to have a very normal family life. As I say, it was a proper job, and we had a very nice family. And it was just at the right time when the girls were sort of how old would they be? About 11 and 9 or something like that. They were, you know, and it was rotten for them at times. You know, because maybe go on holiday. I remember going on holiday. I remember being in Paris and somebody being on the Champs-Élysées, and I remember somebody shouting across saying, "Hello, Rini, how much is sugar in your shop?" And you know, think people used to say that all the time. You know, and it wasn't so easy for my girls, you know, and my husband, but they weathered it and they didn't mind it at all, you know. And it was a bit of a nuisance for them at school sometimes, you know. The people were a bit jealous of all of that. They had to deal with all that, but they did, and they're fine, and of course one of the daughters is in the business herself. So
it was a very nice time of my life, a very nice time.
It's been fascinating talking to you, and it's taken me back. I'm thinking about I was a little boy sat there watching it on the telly.
Take me back too.
and I saw you the other night. You were on it. You were on again in the in one of the episodes of Open All Hours. I saw that the other night. Actually, they keep showing the old episodes of Open All Hours.
Amazing. That was a really happy part of my life, being with Ronnie Barker.
Really, really nice to talk to you, Madge. It's been lovely.
And you.
Take care.
No, nice to speak with you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Distinct Nostalgia is produced by MIM. And you can hear lots more programmes via the Distinct Nostalgia player. June Brown talks about the early days of EastEnders.
I wouldn't like her for a neighbour, not in the old days, because she was a right old gossip and she was prejudiced a lot. Yeah. But they used her to get rid of prejudice, you know, particularly in the gay storyline with Michael Cashman. Yeah.
Henry Kelly is back and going for gold.
In any quiz programme, you've got to concentrate on what the point is. And I have to watch my breathing. We learned how to control me, the contestants, and the computer. That was part of the gimmick of going for gold. Yes.
These programmes and many more are all available now at distinctnostalgia.com. Get in touch via the Contact Us page on the website. Bye for now.
Distinct Nostalgia is brought to you in partnership with Life Rooms and Mersey Care NHS Foundation Trust. We've lots of activities for you to do at home at liferooms.org. Staying well, staying home.